Talk given Saturday, 29th January 1972. In past centuries, people have talked of the different elements that make up the world as well as ourselves. They have talked in terms of earth, water, light or fire, air, and the word which the Greeks used, ether. The Romans also used it. Cicero uses it. In India, the terms are prithvi, which also means, besides earth, it means cohesion. It means extension. Apas, water, stands for cohesion. Then tejas, light or fire, stands for form. Vayu, air, stands for motion. And akasha, which used to be translated up till the end of the last century and the early part of this century as ether, represents that which is a fundamental to all these others. Various atomic theories sprang up. The earliest is the one of Kanada in India, and I think historically Leucippus and Democritus follow Kanada. Historically, Leucippus and Democritus follow, and then come the Indian theories, the Vaisheshika atomic theory, and of course the theories which were put out in the Sankhya philosophy. Now there is one outstanding difference between these theories as presented by the Greeks and as presented in India. In India, the different elements were correlated with the body, the feelings, the mind, the vitality, and, of course, consciousness. There is one aspect which I have not come across in writings, but I'm sure it must be there somewhere. These different elements represent varying states of awareness, of consciousness. They are definitely related to the different sense functions. And this is the case with the Greeks also. For example, the eye is associated with light, seeing, and so forth. That's the idea. The earth with the body. Water, sometimes with inspiration from the spirit, sometimes with the feelings. Air, with mind, thoughts, and so forth. There are all these different systematic presentations according to the view of the person who propounded them. Now for us today, these elements as such have no useful meaning, because our knowledge of the nature of things has undergone a tremendous transformation since the old days. If we talk of elements today, we mean nothing but the different chemical elements which are the fundamental material stuff of the world of things. The various non-metals, like the gases, nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen, various solid non-metals, like carbon, for instance, very important, most important element where living matter, the protein molecule, is concerned, and so forth. And we have all the ordinary metals that we know of, the pure metals. They are composed of atoms which have no relationship, as far as our actual knowledge goes, with the word atoms as used by the ancients. We have to look at this whole teaching of the past in a different light. As far as the physical aspect goes, the so-called scientific aspect goes, we must of necessity reject the whole of the past on that score. It's quite useless to us. They had marvelous, they spun out really wonderful, ingenious theories about it all. Those of you who have been SES members are pretty well aware of some of the elementary aspects of the Sankhya presentation. That's the one you know. I don't think you know so much about the Vaisheshika presentation. Or do you? Anyone from the SES? No. You see, the Vaisheshika presentation is different. And what has been presented here in the West in terms of the Sankhya philosophy is just the surface part of the whole system as such. We can dispense with that today. The psychological correspondences are helpful, they are useful. And purely because of the psychological correspondences, it is useful and very convenient for us even today to talk in terms of fire, air, earth, water, ether, in order to understand what is really important from the point of view of living the holy life. Now, the crucial point is our approach to the elements. Take the body, the physical body as we call it. We know that it is composed of matter in all three states, solid, liquid, gaseous. They knew about this right from ancient times, of course. Only we talk in terms of the solid state. They talked of it as earth. We talk of the liquid state. They talked of water. They specifically singled out water. We talk of it as so many different gases, oxygen, nitrogen, and so forth, which we breathe in. Carbon dioxide, and which we breathe out. We talk in those terms. They talked of it as vayu, air. And when they talked of the physical aspect, they meant simply air, the air of the atmosphere which we breathe in. They also used the word vayu in various other meanings, which need not concern us here at the moment. But we know that there is this solid, liquid, and gaseous state simultaneously present in the living body. But that is not all. There is much more beside. today it would be most useful, when I say today, I mean in our present age, it would be most useful if we understood that the wholeness and the whole approach, the approach from the standpoint of the integration of all the different elements to make up the body, is the valuable approach. It's no good trying to analyze and acquire knowledge about the parts by themselves unless we can relate that to the integrated whole. The significance, the meaning of the parts depends upon the whole. And the body is not just a physical body. This which we experience as ourselves, which we experience as other living people, is an integrated whole, so wonderful that we know, actually know, only a very tiny fragment of it all, despite the fact that in modern times we have an encyclopedic knowledge of the body alone through medical science and research and so forth. But there is much, much more to it all. Now, if we remain aware of that wholeness, then approach the different parts, the different aspects, their real significance and their practical value to us as far as the living of the holy life is concerned, will emerge. Now in this, it is our attitude, the attitude of our approach, which is of fundamental importance. We'll take the element water. I'm just going to use the word element for convenience. Take the element water. How do we experience it? Water for drinking. I am thirsty. I want a glass of water. I take it and drink it. What has been the state of my awareness, my consciousness, in that whole process? I am thirsty. I want a glass of water. In some parts of the world they'd ask for a double scotch. But that's neither here nor there. That also is water for the ancients. I want a glass of water. I drink it till I am satisfied. Then I put the glass down and say, ah, that's better. What has the whole event been? Has it been a pure event as part of a universal becoming process, or has it been the usual self-centered, self-enclosed, separative activity? This is the important point. It's the same with food. So if we take solid food, now that's earth. I'm hungry. I must eat something. How do I go for it? Consider the entire self-centeredness involved there and the greed involved there. Now if the food is pleasing, what happens in the psyche? And if the food is displeasing, what happens in the psyche? Now, according as the food or the drink, as the case may be, is pleasing or displeasing, and it is prepared by and served by myself or by others, what are my reactions towards myself, towards others? See what is happening. In the simple act of eating and drinking, of ingesting earth and water, is the activity and the process a pure one, a whole one, a holy one, or is it the usual something which is tainted by greed, by resentment, by attachment, by aversion, and so on? You might say, I'm making mountains out of molehills. If you have a sufficient number of molehills, you will get a mountain. And where eating and drinking are concerned, those little molehills start from the word go. And the longer we live, the bigger is the mountain. But you see, what's involved in terms of the mode of awareness of existence and the whole of spiritual fulfillment, as we know, the whole of the living of the holy life really rests upon this fundamental point, that it is a transformation of our mode of awareness of existence, of our total existence. Let's look at another aspect of this. Again, take the element water. We touched upon water which we drink. Now look at our approach to water with which we wash or enjoy a bath, have a bath. How do I approach my bath? I deliberately said my very gently. But do I approach it that way? Oh, it's 3 o'clock now. I have been working hard and I really want my bath. A nice, good, hot bath. To lie in and just enjoy myself and get clean. Or, I have an appointment with John Smith. He's a nice fellow. So I want my bath, and I put all sorts of things in it, perfume it and so forth, titivate myself and doll myself up afterwards and all the rest of it, and go to meet John Smith in order to etc., etc., etc. What is my approach to the element water there? We begin to see, perhaps, in these apparently trivial things, that which made the Buddha say, the world is on fire with the fires of greed and hate and delusion. See how subtly they are all involved with the elements that make up life. No, I shouldn't have said life. With the elements that make up the whole of the becoming process, which includes, of course, ourselves. And this is so, not merely physically, it is so psychologically too. There is the psychological earth, the rocks, the hard, fixed ideas, convictions, irrefutable dogmas, doctrines, beliefs, and all the rest of it. There are the ideas and thoughts which are like fire. The man who is determined to change the world according to his image. He produces systems of philosophy even. And we see a good many examples of the effects of those systems of philosophy. Take political philosophy, if you like. Any of you have ever, has any one of you ever really studied any particular political philosophy as such in detail? Take some of the old ones. In China, Sun Tzu, and in India, Kautilya, both produced political philosophies based upon the idea that man, in a state of nature, is an evil creature. He will kill you and seize your property and take away your wife and children. He's a beast. It may be true to the facts. It is somewhat true to the facts of what happens. But if that idea is accepted as a foundational idea, then your system, your political system which you rear upon it, can never escape from the bounds, the iron bounds of greed and hate and delusion. Can't escape from it. Kautilya in India is more Machiavellian than Machiavelli in several respects. I've got Kautilya's Arthashastra with me. And I've been through the whole of it. You take the political philosophies which sprang up later on, of course Machiavelli we know, and so forth. Take Hobbes. Take Karl Marx. And see what has happened. A system of ideas. A person is full of fire with his ideas, and see what that fire does. Does it warm and comfort? Does it sustain life? Or does it scorch and burn and destroy? What does that fire do? What is one's approach to ideas? So you see, psychologically too, it is a question of the approach. And likewise, spiritually. Your ardent devotee with burning eyes, titanic repressions inside him, comes to the Holy One and says, I must find God. If he'd only take the trouble to let his eyes see and let his ears hear, he would see and hear God all the time. He just, what's his, why? Because of his approach, I must find, I want. There's the basic greed. There is the sense of frustration. Oh no, this what this man told me is no good. But how do I know that it is no good? Of course, there are exceptions. We know that some people do talk somewhat nonsensically. But apart from that, how do I know that it is not good? Because my mind is already closed. I'm not open. I I'm not considerate. I'm not prepared to consider. Then I come across somebody, this is it. He is the one. He is the one and only one. Why? Because he has said certain words which please me, which give me satisfaction. And how and why do they please me? Because they say yes to my preconceptions and assumptions. How often have all of us said, exactly, I thought so. I told you so. Yes? My preconception and assumption. So you see, it is a question of the approach, isn't it? Is that a pure approach? Now, when my approach is impure, I go through the experience impurely. Take my bath, for titivating myself, beautifying myself, or just enjoying myself, and so forth and so forth. And it is my bath, my right. That whole approach is a mistaken approach, isn't it? And the result is that my psychical reactions charge the psychical atmosphere around me with something which is not exactly wholesome, holy. Therefore, what I am doing is to add to the impurity of the psychical atmosphere as it is, and God knows it is impure enough. We have only to listen to the news for 5 minutes to see what is going on in the world. The hate and the horror and the destruction that goes on. And I'm adding to it all the time. By my reactions. And why do I have these reactions? Because I am seeking something for myself. Put it in the big way, I am aware of existence in the unholy way. That is why in my own psyche all this takes place, and I charge the psychical atmosphere with it. Now let us look at another aspect of it. I'm a scientist. I'm a very good cook. Right. I take all the good foods, the right foods, the pure materials, you see, and prepare the scientifically perfect food, etc. If I eat that sort of food, I shall be healthy, I shall be well, I shall be strong, I shall set an example to everybody else, and so forth. Now, if I approach that material, whether it be solid or liquid, food or drink, earth or water, if I approach that material that way, I call it, from the scientific point of view, absolutely pure material, fresh-grown, compost-grown, pure water from the spring and all the rest of it, you see? Does it remain pure with my impure psyche impinging upon it? Take another example. I have a dog. A very nice dog. Or I have a cat. Charming cat. Perfectly harmless creature, well trained, very good companion. Now, If I am in a rage, either with the dog or with anything else, or anybody else beside me, does the dog or the cat remain the perfectly harmless, affectionate pet or not? Does the dog take on my viciousness or not? We know very well, and the famous saying, tell me what company you keep and I'll tell you what you are. We know very well from our experience that if we keep what we commonly call bad company or evil company, we become tainted. We become infected with that illness, with that taint, don't we? One of the very important teachings given in all the great religious disciplines of the world, I don't know of any exception, a very important point is, take care what company you keep. Of course, in the modern world, under modern conditions and circumstances, we cannot pick and choose our company. We are compelled into the company in which we find ourselves. Our daily work, our means of earning our daily bread compels that. Very few of us are fortunate enough to be able to exercise some sort of judgment in the matter. We are forced into situations where the company is unsuitable, to put it gently. It's disturbing. Or if it is on the side of pleasure, of relaxation, it is self-indulgent. Under the stress and strain of life, people become even more self-indulgent. Hectic life of the city or business or whatever the work is in which one is involved with the vast milling crowds. And then we relax by drink or drugs or excessive, unbalanced pleasure-making of some sort or other, an escape from life, from the reality of life, a running away from that with which we are unable to deal and have a perfect and a right relationship with. Modern life tries us very much more severely than life in the old days did. In the old days, it was much easier to get your DD, your Doctor of Divinity in Holiness, than it is in modern times. Much easier. So you see, the approach will make what is, in the normal way, quite a simple and a pure thing, impure. Because my approach is wrong. It is necessary for us to understand this, really to understand it. Now I have used the terms pick and choose company or this, that or the other. That is, we are discriminating between this and that on the basis of our judgment our moralistic judgment, whether it is good or evil. But that is the lesser way. And it only leads into another entanglement. The real thing is to be wholly attentive, wholly mindful. For in that mindfulness, there is neither attachment nor aversion, neither acceptance of a part and the rejection of another part. And in this state, one absorbs the totality of the experience. And in that absorbing, oneself remaining as poised as possible, is the transformation not only of one's own awareness, but of the entire situation. It is the medicine for the whole situation. Difficult. Very difficult. But what other way is there? There is no other way. There is only the way. Because the way is the whole way, the total way. Whole not in the sense of quantity, but whole in the sense of the wholeness of the entire situation. That is all taken in. Now, let us look back upon the situation which we call oneself, which means basically the body. Earth, water, light or fire, air, akasha, ether, they're all there. Or if you want to be very chemistry-minded, you can say that the oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, temperatures, pressures, electrochemical energies and processes, etc., they are all there. Yes. Now, we are aware of them in terms of possessiveness. There is a lust, a greed, which attaches us to the different elements composing us. And it is an unconscious attachment. We hold on to it. Without that holding on, these elements would find no footing in our awareness. Now note carefully, these elements would find no footing in our awareness. And if they find no footing, they cannot bind our consciousness, which leaves us in the state of freedom to live in true inward holiness. There is a very profound statement which the Buddha made when he was talking with a person called Kevaddha. Now, Kevaddha listens to something which the Buddha says about a bhikkhu who came to him, the Buddha. And he tells Kevadatta that this bhikkhu first went to Brahma and asked the question. The question asked was this: where do the four great elements, earth, water, fire and air, cease, leaving no trace behind? Where do these elements cease, leaving no trace behind? The question, as you see, is asked objectively, as if these elements were external only to the questioner. Note that point first. The statement, leaving no trace behind, implies that there won't be another uprising, another conditioned state, another birth of a similar pattern or a similar situation, another jati, as we would say in Pali, leaving no trace behind. That means that the whole business is finished forever at last. The confinement to the becoming process is at an end. This is what he's after. But note the form in which that bhikkhu asked the question of Brahma. Where do the four great elements, earth, water, fire and air, cease, leaving no trace behind? Now the Buddha relates this to Kevadatta and then says that that bhikkhu was told by Brahma, "I don't know." The great god Brahma didn't know. He said, "There is the exalted one. You should go to him and ask him. Don't come and ask me. He will enlighten you." So the bhikkhu comes to the Buddha and asks the same question. And the Buddha says, "Now the question, O bhikkhu, should not be put as you have put it. Instead of asking where the four great elements cease, leaving no trace behind, you should have asked, where do earth, water, fire and air, and long and short, and fine and coarse, pure and impure, no footing find?" Now you see the significance of this question. As far as you or I as individual beings are concerned, there is no cessation to earth, water, fire. The world process will go on. It was there before you and I were born. It will continue after you and I are dead. The elements will go on. It's an absurd question. And the elements in themselves are neither pure nor impure, neither holy nor unholy. They are as an absolute existence. So the question is a wrong question. If I want the elements to cease because thereby I will be freed, I certainly am not free. It is an impossibility. But if you put the question this way, where do the elements, etc., find no footing, and where is it that both name and form, nama rupa, die out, leaving no trace behind? Then the question is rightly put. Because name and form are dependent upon the fact of the of all that there is, forming a pattern, because this is the great world process which we can't control or stop. They combine together, form the pattern which is you or I. But you or I have consciousness, have the power of perception into the nature of things. We can look within ourselves and outside ourselves, differentiate between the two, and so on and so on. So now, this is a matter of consciousness. If the elements, if processes, if that which is limited, particular, mortal, finite, painful, sorrowful, ill, if all that is no longer to make our awareness of existence unholy, then all those must find no footing in our awareness, no hold upon our awareness. So, the Buddha gives the right form in which the question should be put. You see, way back in those days, they thoroughly understood that if a question is rightly formulated, it contains its answer. On that, the answer is Vijnanam Anidassanam Anantam Sabbato Pabam. Vijnanam is what he uses. Vijnanam is discriminative consciousness. So I'll give the whole translation using the term discriminative consciousness. Discriminative consciousness, which is characterless, which is invisible, therefore. If it has no characteristics, the senses and the discursive mind cannot possibly observe it. Which is characterless, which is infinite, endless, anantam, which is infinite, shining everywhere. In that awareness, which is the ultimate awareness, the pure awareness, the absolute consciousness, none of these elements find a footing. Finding a footing means exercising a limiting influence, binding influence. The Upanishad, the Sarvasara Upanishad, uses just the right word, bandha, a binding power. Now, what is it that unbinds us from the elements? That means from the whole universal process which we experience all day, every day. What is it that unbinds us? The cessation of all grasping, isn't it? It is because we grasp, because we do not see that this is the relative, this is not the absolute. We do not see that this is not transcendent. Therefore, we grasp. We cling to it. Let's go back to what I suggested earlier. I take a bath. Do I take it without any clinging, without any grasping of any sort? Do I let it happen as the right and natural action of an unimpeded, pure becoming process? If I do that, then that bath purifies the whole of me, not merely the body. My whole being is purified. Why do you think some people get inspiration when they have a bath? They get a real insight. because that aspect of true purification is taking place. Is that so or is it not so? What do you think? All little things again, but the molehills make the mountain, remember. This is a most useful subject for real meditation, strenuous meditation. Look into it every day. What are our psycho-mental associations in relation to all the elements that constitute us, the world, and the process of our daily life? What are our psycho-mental associations with them? With going into a restaurant and having a meal, with getting into your car and driving to the office or to the seaside or whatever it is, with writing a letter or anything that we do, the psycho-mental associations. Now, I deliberately use this term in a special sense. We all know the meaning of psycho-mental, but I'll tell you what I have in mind. The psychological part, the psycho part, is that which is specific to us. Our specific emotional, intellectual, psychical processes in reaction to all stimuli and actions and events and so forth. That is the psycho part of it. And when I use the word mental in this context, I'm not confining it to our ordinary mental processes, which actually are just the limited mentality. Strictly speaking, they are the psychical processes, the psychological part of us. I'm using the word mental in the sense of pure mind, mind only, this transcendent energy. Because this transcendent energy is through us all the time, just as space is through us all the time, unstoppable, uncontrollable, unseizable. It cannot be grasped, but it acts all the time. It acts. There is this non-compelling power of transcendent energy, which is pure mind. Now, that power reacting with the formations, the particular ideas, thoughts, desires, likes, dislikes, etc., which constitute our psychical life, reacting with that brings out a reaction of ideals. Our ideals, I believe, have that as the original motivation. This transcendent element, which is present all the time, makes the living organism throw up and ought to be. This is the perfect thing. This is how it ought to be. Now, when one experiences perfection in the pure way, there is no thought form produced, a mind picture produced, and still less is it set up as an ought to be. You see, this is our ignorance, the state of avidya. This is our ignorance which makes us always make pictures of the beloved and lets the living beloved go away. And therefore we are left fiddling away with the picture, which is dead. Our picture. This is what happens with an ought-to-be ideal. Just paper and ink. Chuck it into the waste paper basket. But it is an activity of transcendent mind which makes me, in the state of ignorance and incapacity, throw up the ideal. So now, in relation to every element, earth, water, fire, air, in relation to every experience, in relation to every circumstance, situation, other people, inanimate objects and so forth, all of which are part of the becoming process, all of which are composed of the different elements only, you see. In relation to all that, I have to remain completely mindful and watch what happens. I have to be completely mindful of my psycho-mental associations. Take, for example, meeting a friend. You make an appointment with somebody. Let's go tonight to the theater, or we'll have dinner before or after, as the case may be, and so forth. Each one of us will dress in a certain way, will prepare ourselves in a certain way, fit and proper for the occasion and all the rest of it, and behave in a certain way, and so on. And when we meet, and during our meeting, there will be a reaction process going on all the time, with each one's brain chattering back at the whole of the other one. How he or she has dressed, how he or she is talking, how he or she is enjoying the play, the performance, the actors, the food afterwards, and so forth and so forth. And notice the nature of that chatter. There is one aspect which is the ought to be, the perfect meeting, the perfect restaurant, and the perfect food, and the perfect play, and the theater, and all the rest of it. There is that ideal, the imposition of an ideal aspect, and there is the ordinary experiential aspect of the whole situation in terms of what feeling we go through. All right? So you see, this sort of thing is what we have to look at. The psycho-mental associations with anything and everything. I don't know whether I mentioned it here to you, but at one of the group meetings, I spoke one day about my collar stud, which I've used since 1917. My father dropped it on the floor. I picked it up and he said, "Sonny, you use that. You can have that now. It's a nice gold stud." And I've used it ever since, you see. Now, whenever I handle that stud, or think of it, or think of that event, my psycho-mental associations I look at. Now only. what is it? 1972. 55 years later. And gather some wisdom in relation to being free of possessiveness, of a subtle pride, a subtle selfness associated with the collar stud my father gave me. But you see, when little things like that add up 100 million, 1,000 million times in our lifetime, and they do add up that much. Consider the speed with which feelings and thoughts move, and the number of times they repeat. It has become a big force, isn't it? So So now the study of the elements from the point of view of living the religious life should be conducted in this way, one's approach to the elements, in what sort of spirit one approaches the elements. And it is a very useful way of examining the situation, because these are the fundamentals which make up everything in our life. Persons, situations, relationships, everything comes into it. Now, they find no footing in that transcendent awareness which is invisible, which is infinite, which is shining everywhere. The texts use two different words. The Digha Nikaya uses one word, and the Majjhima Nikaya uses another word. The Majjhima uses Pabham, the Digha uses Pahang. Some translators use the same word, shining everywhere. Dr. Konza uses a very interesting word, accessible everywhere. Differentiates between Pabham and Pahang. Accessible everywhere. But whether you use accessible everywhere or shining everywhere, as far as you and I are concerned, fundamentally it means the same thing. See? So now, an understanding of the elements in the holy way would make us realize, actually realize, here now, transcendence itself is the seed. Transcendence itself is the tree and the flower. Transcendence is the beginning, the proceeding, and the ending. And when we realize that, we are free of the last of the difficulties which beset us. The separation of samsara, of the becoming process, of the relative, from nirvana, the absolute. There is that separation in our own awareness. And it stays almost right to the very end. When that separation is out, here now, this is that. The totality is here. And the totality has realized itself through you, the individual, in terms of that perfect holiness, which is the true fulfillment of each person as a human being.